Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Toby Miller, sitting in for Ian Masters. Ian is overseas for a screening of a controversial film he made for the BBC 40 years ago about the Sydney Opera House that was willfully destroyed but has since been resurrected. Today, we have a star-studded lineup for you. We start with the debt and default crisis. The New Republic's Jonathan Cohen reports on the latest. Then Andrew Ross from NYU examines alternatives to debt, this time not government debt, but personal debt. And we close with Sara Aish of Greenpeace, who updates us on the seizure and imprisonment of the Arctic 30 by Russia. Joining us now is Jonathan Cohen, a senior editor at The New Republic. Previously, he was executive editor of The American Prospect, and he's the author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. He has an article at The New Republic, which I've just read and is terrific, called The Republicans May Lose, But So Will You, and he tweets at Citizen Cohen. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Cohen.
Well, thanks for having me on your show.
Great to have you. So, the government shutdown, this is like watching the World Series and it's, you know, the bottom of the ninth and it's the seventh game and who knows what's happening, right?
Right. I mean, I think at this point we kind of, you know, it looks like there's two outs and, you know, the team that's behind, you know, they got nobody on base down at their last strike. I mean, it looks like we see the end of this now, so hopefully we're done, but, you know, it isn't over till it's over. But we'll see.
And one of the people who may be over out of all of this is John Boehner. How do you read his conduct in the histrionics of the last few weeks, and where do you think he sits in the Republican heart?
So, you know, Boehner is a really interesting character. I mean, he's really the central character in some ways, more than, you know, when you think about who's the center of this story, more than anybody else, more than Ted Cruz, more than President Obama, this has really been about Speaker John Boehner. You know, I think Boehner, in his heart of hearts, is an old-school politician. He's very conservative, but also someone who's used to the sort of, you know, world where you make deals and you do things in the sort of normal way of business. And he's got, you know, he is in charge of a Republican caucus with a large number of members from the Tea Party who are, frankly, much more extreme ideologically and also much more extreme in terms of the tactics they endorse. And, you know, if you want to think about it this way, you know, we have a constitution that sets the rules for how Congress and the presidency operate, but there's also a kind of set of understandings about how they're going to govern and sort of good faith and when you compromise and make deals. And the sort of Tea Party wing of his party doesn't want to play by those rules. And, you know, they were the ones who came up with the idea of, hey, let's shut down the government and let's threaten not to raise the debt ceiling so that we'll default on our payments. And we'll threaten all this if we don't get what we want, which is to end the president's health care law. And Boehner, as the speaker, is in charge of these people and has to try to kind of corral them and get them, you know, keep them united against his better judgment, has basically deferred to them and let them call the plays. And I think he has done that in part because he's afraid. He thinks that if he doesn't, they have enough power to depose him as the speaker. So, that's basically how he got into this. And it's been a sort of amazing spectacle because, I mean, his lieutenants have said, we think this is a really bad idea and this is going to backfire. We're not going to win this fight. And yet they went ahead with it. And I think everybody sort of figured that he was going to do what he had done before, which is wait until the last possible minute, try everything they wanted him to try, and then he could come to them and say, hey, guys, I did it your way. I tried. We can't win on this. The American people aren't behind us. The president isn't going to negotiate with a gun to his head. We just have to go ahead and reopen the government and raise the debt ceiling. And that's what he did. But, you know, by waiting this long, they've done all sorts of damage to the American economy, I think to American credibility abroad. And, you know, you just have to wonder, did he have to wait so long? I mean, what could he have taken a harder stand at some point and basically confronted his caucus and sort of put on the line and said, look, I know you want this, but you can't have it. And if you want to depose me, depose me, but I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. It feels as though there's a lack of courage there, which is the last thing you're allowed to level as an accusation at a member of the Republican Party, apparently. Their masculinity is deeply compromised if you do so. But Jonathan Cohen, you've You've talked about this in terms of the damage that it will do to us as Americans, and despite my accent, I actually am one. What do you think the damage is domestically? Internationally, our reputation is in tatters, as incompetent and irrational, but it might have been like that for quite a while anyway. But domestically, what does it do for our sense of self and our sense of confidence?
Right. Well, so, you know, quite apart from, there are tangible economic costs to what we're doing. You know, Standard & Poor's just put out a sort of study that said they basically, if I'm remembering the number correctly, they think this drama, this shutdown, has cost us basically $25 billion in wealth. Now, that sounds like a lot in the grand scheme of things. $25 billion of an entire economy is not that much money, but it is something, and it does translate down. And so we've all paid a price. But I also think, again, you know, I think that as a country, we depend upon our leaders to work things out and to have, you know, I think it's good to have debates. It's good to have vigorous debates. I have no problem with the fact that there are people in this country who have very strong feelings on one way or the other, and that includes people who don't agree with me. You know, I'm a liberal. I understand the Tea Party arguments. I don't agree with them, but, you know, let's have these arguments. Let's debate these things. Let's debate them vigorously. Fine. But it's very, very important that everybody who is a part of that debate in Washington, the people who are elected to represent us, understand that they have a responsibility to act like adults, to say at some point, look, we can't just all sit in our corners and sort of stamp our feet and demand that things go the way we want to. And we need that to run. We need that to build, both for the sake of having a functioning government, but also, I think, for reminding all of us as Americans that we may disagree about things, but we're all part of the same country, and there's a sort of common set of beliefs, a common set of ideas. You know, somebody, I can't remember who now, originally said that, you know, really, you know, democracy is, you know, belief in democracy is sort of a religion in this country, and it requires everyone to sort of buy into it, you know, to buy into this idea that we're all part of the same society. We're going to have some give and take, but at the end of the day, that's going to work.
Now, Jonathan,
I feel like this has been a threat to that. This has been a challenge. That this is one group of people who are basically saying, we're not willing to engage in that give and take. We don't feel like that works for us. We have to have things our way. I mean, remember, this is all about the Tea Party. This all started because they don't like the health care law. A health care law that passed both houses of Congress and that was signed by a president who ran on a promise to pass the health care law. It was then upheld by the Supreme Court. And then there was a presidential election in which it was a very prominent issue. And the guy who signed the law ran against the guy promising to repeal the law. And the guy who signed the law won in a landslide. So, you know, the Democratic verdict on this law has been rendered. And it is time, I think, for the people who oppose that to recognize that. And if they want to repeal the law, fine. They can keep trying to repeal it. But, you know, until they repeal the law, it is the law of the land. And at some point, I feel like they need to understand that and be willing to move forward. And what I'm seeing here is a sort of statement that when you don't like the outcome of an election, when you don't like the way Congress votes, you know, you get to basically throw a temper tantrum and just stop everything from working until you get your way. And we can't have that.
Have that. Jonathan, we started by speaking about the impact that this would probably have on John Boehner. What about President Obama? And I ask because if we go back two decades and we think of when something similar happened between Newton Gingrich and William Jefferson Clinton, Clinton really won the day, hands down, and he did it by saying, I'm here to do the people's business. What are you doing? Has Obama had as straightforward and clear a message as Clinton did? And is he going to win the day as comprehensively, as hands down, as Clinton did?
You know, it's really hard to know. You know, the one thing that you have to say, the two things about Clinton were, number one, Clinton had the benefit of a really, really strongly growing economy. And political scientists will tell you that when you are looking at this sort of success of presidents, or any politicians, the economy is such a huge factor. And the economy is not as strong today. It is recovering from the recession. It's recovering steadily, but very slowly, and this is not going to help that. It's going to get a little weaker because of this episode. So Obama will not have that wind at his back. On the other hand, I think Obama has always benefited throughout his presidency, even at its lowest points, from a perception, a widely shared perception, that he is responsible, that he is a grown-up, that he is honest, and he is trying to do the right thing. There's a part of the country that has never accepted him, that really hates him, but it's a small part of the country, relatively speaking. Most Americans, even a lot of Americans who don't end up voting for him, they think he's basically a decent guy, and they trust him. They think he's a grown-up, you know, he's mature. And I think this episode reinforces that image, that, you know, he was the adult in the room, along with some other people. You know, he was trying to do the right thing, and we had these yahoos over here, you know, basically trying to wreck the government, wreck the economy in order to get their way. So I think he does pick up something from that. And I also think, you know, within Washington, this episode has really bound the different Democratic leaders to each other. It was really remarkable to watch the unity on display among the different branches. I mean, you had Nancy Pelosi, head of the Democrats in the House of Representatives. You had Harry Reid, head of the Democrats in the Senate, President Obama, and they spoke with one voice, and they coordinated. There was, you never heard about dissent among them. And within the two houses of Congress, you barely, almost never heard dissent among Democrats in the House or Democrats in the Republican. They spoke with Democrats in the Senate. They spoke with one voice. I actually think that is going to help the Democrats going forward, because these are habits in Washington. You know, when you're used to fighting with each other, you keep fighting with each other. When you start working together, it just feels more natural. And, you know, little things like the staff members get to know each other better. And there's just some trust that's been built up. I think that will help them going forward, because if you are united and the other party is full of divisions, as the Republicans are now, it's going to help to press their case. Maybe not in ways that's obvious to you know, out in public, but inside Washington, as issues move forward and they have to negotiate on things, I suspect that will help.
Jonathan Cohn, thank you for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Jonathan Cohn, a senior editor at The New Republic. Previously, he was executive editor of The American Prospect and is the author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. He has an article in The New Republic recently, The Republicans May Lose, But So Will You, and he tweets at Citizen Cohn. We'll take a break now for station identification, and then we'll be back to discuss personal debt and student debt with NYU's Andrew Ross.
Outside the passion, millions put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, betting, hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding.